Rocky's praying about God's plan being simplified. I'm adding like the organization of the church, which is extremely simple, what God set up, independent under a certain structure, autonomous group. And as we'll talk about a little bit later, or we'll see it, something entirely different out of the JW organization. It's structured very much like a, in many ways, like a corporation. And certainly operates that way up to once you reach a certain point. So we want to take up Freddie. Freddie came into the presidency rather late in life, as it turns out, and he would end up being the oldest president when he passed away that they had ever had. Not that that's particularly significant, just an observation about the kind of the age of the people when you eventually reach that upper echelon of the JW organization. He started out in being born in Covington, Kentucky, and went to school at the University of Cincinnati. And he actually had intended to be a Presbyterian preacher when he entered school. And so he took up the study of Greek, probably ended up in, or not probably, ended up in school only for a couple of years, never did graduate. But he took, as I say, took Greek while he was in school. He was actually up for a Rhodes Scholarship, or up for the examination to get a Rhodes Scholarship while he was at the university. But in the course of time, while he was there, his brother actually introduced him to the JWs, gave him some material, and that he started reading that material. Part of which was studies of the scriptures we talked about before. And so he broke off his connection with Presbyterians and got involved with the JWs. And when that happened, he lost interest in scholarship. And he actually had his name withdrawn from the list of those that would take the test for the Rhodes Scholarship. And I'll point out to you why that has meaning in a moment. He became a pioneer early on, after he decided to join the, actually what it was called, the Bible Students Organization, typical in those days. He rose up through the ranks, ended up going to Bethel in 1920. Bethel, by the way, Bethel was a generic term used for a certain level of the organization, branch, I believe. Wherever their branch location is, they'll call it Bethel. So typically, in the States, Bethel, we associate it with New York, and that's where he was. He would rise up through the Bethel organization, there, the JW organization, and become vice president. And then when Noor died, he ended up being president, taking over from Noor. He is basically the scholarship behind the New World Translation. So here's a man that took 2 years of Greek. Well, I'm not even sure he took 2 full years of Greek. He took some Greek, put it that way. And when they put out the New World Translation, which we'll spend a little bit of time on later, they would not, as I mentioned in an earlier class, they did not, would not tell who the translating committee was. But insiders, particularly those who left the JWs, could, you know, report it that Freddie France was really the guy responsible for the New World Translation, for that their Bible. And there was a committee, but more than that. But he was the only one, as far as I know, you know, find out. He was really the only one that knew any Greek, and he knew precious little.
And I couldn't find it, you know, early on either. Did they use the manuscripts, or did they go back to the early manuscripts, the early documents, and translate, or did they, God the Holy Spirit, just, you know, take the King James Bible or whatever, you know, or some of that and translate?
Truth be known, proof is, I don't know. I'm going to say two things about that. One is they relied very heavily on, remember the emphatic diglots we talked about, which was a Greek-English translation, a parallel, kind of like an interlinear, except they were just in parallel columns. They used that, and depended upon that, it depended on the ASV. I favored the ASV a lot. But when you recognize that there were no scholars, I mean, there were no people that really knew Greek other than Freddie, and no one knew Hebrew, to think they went back to original documents is, you know, they may have gone back to them and looked at them and said, those are interesting, but they couldn't do anything with it. It's nothing like the process by which the New American Standard was translated, or the King James was translated, for that matter. There is a, and I think I'll cover it here. I have it also, I'm going to talk about it when we do the New World Translation, but it's worth talking about here. There's a, you'll see this referenced in your lesson in various places. There was a trial in Scotland in 1954, and it was really a guy that brought suit because they wanted to draft Scott, they wanted to draft him into the army, and so he brought suit in Scotland because of that. And I say it was in 1954. I don't even know what the war or what the military reason would have been in 54, but that was the issue. And so the general question: could a JW be drafted in Scotland? So they had this trial. Freddie France is called to the stand here, and we'll give you the dialogue. Here's the attorney. Have you made yourself familiar with Hebrew? France, yes. So you have a substantial linguistic apparatus at your command. France, yes, for use of my biblical work. Attorney, I think you're able to read the Bible in Hebrew, Greek, Latin, Spanish, Portuguese, German, and French. His answer, yes. Attorney, you yourself read and speak Hebrew, do you? France, I do not speak Hebrew. Attorney, you do not? No. Can you yourself translate that into Hebrew? France asks, which? The fourth verse of the second chapter of Genesis. You mean here? Attorney, yes. No, I wouldn't attempt to do that. Simple exercise for Hebrew students. No problem translating. Should be no problem translating Genesis 2:4. He couldn't do it. I mentioned the Rhodes Scholar a minute ago. They asked him a question about getting offered a Rhodes Scholarship. Now, when you get offered a Rhodes Scholarship, you take an examination. And so, you know, you can be offered to be go to the examination, but that's not the Rhodes Scholarship. He makes the point, France says. I was offered a Cecil Rhodes Scholarship. I took an examination for that in the University of Ohio. What year? That was 1914, but in view of my decision as a ministry, as one of Jehovah's Witnesses, I turned that down. So his point was, I took the test, I was accepted, but I decided not to take the scholarship. So they had an affidavit, I suppose, from the Rhodes Scholarship Trust. I have checked our records and do not find that Frederick France was elected to the Rhodes Scholarship. So he never took the test, therefore he never was elected, but he projected himself as a scholar, and I took the test, and you know, I passed and decided not to take the scholarship. I say that may have been an affidavit. That quote from the Rhodes Scholarship people may have just been an after-the-fact quote that they got. But in any event, that's a documented record. As I say, he died in 92. He became joined in the group in 1913. That's when he was baptized. And his death was on the forefront of something that was going to happen. He served from what year? 77 to 92. They're going to have a reorganization in the year 2000, so they're approaching that. One of the issues they had, and I've mentioned this previously when we're talking about Rutherford, the JWs teach, and Rutherford introduced this, there are two classes, right? There's the 144,000, and then there's the Great Cloud. Well, as time is going on, since the 144,000, that was closed in 1935. You had to be a JW by 1935 to be in that class. And they're approaching the point now in the 90s where they're saying, you know, it's been 65 years, going on 65 years, and you had 15 or 20 of that for somebody who was young and came into the group, and you're starting to get up to the point where people are going to be living, there's not going to be anybody living. It was in the group before 35. So, Rutherford came to this great cat cloud concept. Because originally it was all JWs were in the 144,000, so he came up with this great cloud concept that those outside of that group, all others, in other words, would end up living in paradise, on earth, in earthly paradise. And these were all, you also hear the term other sheep, these folks. There are a couple of differentiations when it comes into the leadership, and this is really setting the stage for what we'll be talking about later. The great crowd, the other sheep, have traditionally not been allowed into the leadership. So when we talk about leadership as a governing body, it is those who are part of the 144,000. And they have no hope of heaven, I mentioned. It's only hope of a paradise on earth. And more importantly, or as important, I suppose, they are taught they're not anointed with the Holy Spirit, nor does God communicate with them. So if you're depending upon the organization to be God's spokesman, and you got to be one of the 144,000 to be part of God's spokesman, which means, you know, if the crowd outside is not part of that, you can see there's a dilemma coming sooner or later. There would be no more 144,000. It would have all been picked. And now who's going to be the spokesman? So they're going to have a problem coming. They also insist that this 144,000 are born again, and only they are born again. And technically, Jesus is a mediator only of that group. And for the other sheep, the great crowd, they have to look to the Watchtower Bible Crack Society to be their salvation. So, if you were to become a JW right now, the only way you could be saved is through that organization, not through Jesus. That's what they were teaching. Okay? In the 80s. Alright, next guy is Henschel in this group. He actually was one of the youngest on the governing body. He was going to be 72, and the general age was 83, so he came in as a kid. He started going door to door back in the 30s, became a full-time minister in 34. So again, he's one of those that was just made it under the cutoff point for the 144,000. He also moved to Brooklyn. Father moved to Brooklyn, and he ended up getting involved with Bethel and Brooklyn. And he would move to their secretary, the job of secretary to Noah, the third president. And then when France died, then he would later become the guy who took his place. He became a part of the governing body even before that. So he was in a position. Remember, I've talked about this before. This is a corporation. There's training that goes on. You move up. You see all these guys eventually show up in headquarters. and they get rotated through jobs, or they hold in jobs that puts them in close proximity to the president. And I guess in all cases, along that path, they have to be put on the governing body to be able to get to be president at that point in time. And that will start. In 2000, he started as president in 2000. In 93, he's the first one that gave up his presidency without death. And the reason for that is they reorganized the JW. The prior to the 70-71 time frame, you ended up having the board of directors and the governing body being one and the same. Remember, there were seven on each one. And then when you hit 71, they started bringing out some non-board members to the governing body. We'll talk about that in organization. Well, when 2000 comes along, they end up splitting those two bodies in terms of participation. And so that when that happened, that's part of what happened. And at the same time, he went to the governing body. He did not, Henson went to the governing body, did not go to the other body, and therefore he ended up being not on the board of directors, but as president. Okay? So we'll, like I said, we'll talk about that later. A fellow named Don Adams became the president. We'll mention him in a minute, a little more detail. Henschel is the one who, just to give you some highlights of his career, he looked at tissue transplants, all tissue transplants, cannibalism, and that caused a ruckus at the time it happened. He had some views about, or at least under his part of his tenure, and started before him, but he was involved in it in his presidency and activities, and he spoke about it to a fair degree. He claimed the Sodom and Gomorrah people of Sodom and Gomorrah would be resurrected. And you got to remember, resurrection, there is a resurrection in their view, and we'll talk about what that means. But there's also, when you die, all consciousness is gone. And the question is, what kind of people can be resurrected? And so they started out in 79 at Sodom and Gomorrah, people would be resurrected. By 52, it was no. Again, in 65, it was yes. Again, in 82, it was still yes, again. Then in 88, it went to no. Then in 88, later in 88, it was yes, and then in 89, it was no. So you see this, they can't figure out whether the people of Sodom and Gomorrah are going to be resurrected or not. That's just typical of the kind of views they hold on a number, have held over years on a number of subjects. He passed away in 2003, so he's still he's in 144,000. Presumably, but it's fast approaching an end. Then Don Adams came in the vein. Man is currently still president. He's 89 right now, by my math. And so he's getting up in age as well. He started out when family was involved with the Episcopal Church. And his mother's the one who really drew him to the JWs, and he eventually became a witness and served as a full-time preacher. And again, he ended up being in Brooklyn. It helps if you think you want to be president to somehow find your way to Brooklyn. That's where all the action is. So he was served on the governing body as a zone overseer, and we'll talk about what a zone overseer is. And then would eventually become president in 2000. What happens with the organization, reorganization in 2000, presidential role, unlike previously, starting with Russell, it was a very high, a very important position. important for doctrine, policy, running the organization, and that continued through time. Well, this last reorganization occurs, the president job is greatly diminished. Basically, he runs, it's an administrative position now. And there's a, he's the head of the board of directors, or has a board of directors who reports to him. He reports to them. So, and the governing body is a different organization, and they're responsible for the policy and the doctrines and that kind of thing. And so, again, we'll speak to that a little more when we talk about organizations in detail. So those are the key players in an hour and a half or so. Any questions about that stuff?
Did I understand and what I thought was true? The 144,000 were the only ones that could have direct inspiration from God.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so now the governing body, whoever, because the 144,000 is closed.
Well, it's closed, correct.
They do not have.
They do have.
They do have.
You cannot serve on the governing board. They're running out of options now. The governing body must, by charter, have. In fact, I think it's the board of directors actually that has to have members of the 144,000 by charter. You know, it's the board of directors part of. Whether the governing body and the board of directors work together or they're now separate organizations, by charter of this corporation, the board of directors has got to be made up of 144,000, is what they originally said. God's organization. I don't have to, with this group, we don't have to spend any time on this. This is just a review. We talked about it in, we talked about the Mormons. And you know, the universal church, we understand. The local church, simple, straightforward, independent, autonomous, has elders, deacons, and members, period. And that's where it starts, that's where it stops. There are characteristics of local church in terms of its being the ground, the support of the truth, the assembly, the purposes of worship together and edification, pooling money in the common fund, so we work as a commonality as far as how we operate, and churches that have common oversight of a set of elders. Simple. If New Caney wants to go practice spiritual gifts and have school or whatever, well, they can do that. That's what they choose to do. It doesn't directly impact us. It indirectly impacts us, but not directly. We can, you know, this church can still follow the Word of God. So the beauty of God is simple. It's not this interconnectivity. It's not true with the Mormons, it's not true with the J.W.s, not true with the Catholic Church, not true with most organizations, religious organizations. So that is the beauty of God's wisdom, and it shows forth in the church. The Watchtower itself is, I've come at this several ways. I don't mean to confuse you. But there's terminology here that you may run into as you talk to people, and certainly from the standpoint of the people you might talk to at the door, you might as well know who they are or where they are in the organization and what they represent. The society claims it's has the same organization as the first century church. Now, I just described in summary what the first century church organization was, but it's interesting how they rationalize this, I suppose. And again, this is the 54 trial. You got to get a lot of information out of the 54 trial. I read a transcript, a good part of that, and it makes for interesting reading. It's, you know, from a history standpoint. It makes you scratch your head, of course, sometimes. And here's a case in point. Do you regard the organization operation by known for H.J. Davis as modeled in any way in Scripture itself? Covington, by the way, that's who this is. Covington was the legal counsel at the time. So his response is yes. Right? Modeled precisely, not kind of generally, but precisely after the New Testament organization. Well, how? Guy asking how? In what way? I just draw your attention to, he starts off talking about they went door-to-door preaching, legal door-to-door preaching, right? And a house-to-house ministry group, so that's one thing. Well, they did preach, there's no question about that. The quote primitive church. It had a government. Well, we just talked about that. Its government, in view of his comment, its government, we've described it, is because he's looking at it as the whole collective. Well, there is no such animal in that sense. There is a universal church, and the only organization about that is Jesus and safety through all time. And there is no organization on earth, and of course he's trying to get it to an organization on earth. So then he narrows it down. After his death, apostles continued to reside in Jerusalem, and they were considered the governing body of the church. Notice, governing body. Okay. The church at Jerusalem had apostles and elders. They were considered to be the governing body of the church. I believe there were about 70 in number. Now, where does all this come from? This is a man that's part of his organization saying, here, we're organized just like the Bible. Well, where does he get this?
Right out of Acts.
Okay, he picks up and when he twists something.
He tweaked it?
No, he more than tweaked it.
So he
picks up on Acts, Acts 15, and look, this is one of the reasons why study of Acts 15 is for us is so important. To understand what was really going on, because this is what people commonly think of. And of course, they've done more than commonly think of it. They've used it as a basis for an organization. And then he talks about this, I believe there were 70 in number. And where did you get that? See, the only 70 I can associate with that is 70 that Jesus sent out. And no relationship to that and anything else in the New Testament as far as organization of the church. They know something in life on it, so they like on it, I guess. I'm putting words in his mouth because I don't know what he had in mind for sure, but that's kind of the connection. So you see this, how they take and wrest the scripture for their own destruction. And that's just what's happening here. You kind of get just a quick view of it.
And also, this house-to-house thing, of course, it's for study, but there in Acts 2, the apostles went from house to house. And so they're taking the apostles, and putting it to the church, And of course, yes, they had fellowship with each other and everything. But as far as what we see as a church or as a group and everything,
Yeah, and I'm not sure house to house is, as house to house is described. I don't take that to mean literally house to house as much as I take it to be privately. Having a small study is what it is. Not to develop an organizational structure that will go out and purposely go house to house. Now, is it, are we authorized to go house to house? No question about it. No doubt about that. A quick review on review on organizational names. Of course, Adventists started with Miller. This is where Russell started. This is where J.W., where they grew out of. Russell ended up leaving, right? Left the Millerites after the failure of some of these dates that they were prophesying great events would happen around. Started his own magazine, but his roots are clearly And his whole prophecy thing is clearly in a Second Advent kind of philosophy or theology. You'll hear, you know, the things that we hear today that associate with this. Seventh-day Adventist is, I guess, the one I've heard the most of in terms of this country. But there's an Advent Christian Church, the Church of God, parentheses, Faith of Abraham, close parentheses. The Life and Advent Union, these are all outposts of the Millerites. And they're Adventists. His Adventist philosophy or theology. Early on, Russell had them called Bible students, and it stuck with the organization all the way through Rutherford. But again, as time went on, Rutherford changed the name to JW's, Jehovah's Witnesses. We talked about that. We talked about him. That happened in the early 30s. Russell would take Bible students as they started to, his Bible students' name, as they started to grow and get outside of the U.S., then he told them to call yourself part of the International Bible Student Association. And actually, that ended up, and is today, the name of a organization, a corporation in Britain that is part of the JW's and answers to the headquarters organization of the Bible Watchtower. The Watchtower Bible Practice Society. So, Jehovah, of course, Jehovah's Witness is what we're familiar with today. But so-called People's Pulpit Association, another legal corporation formed in New York. It would eventually be renamed, if you drop down to seven, it would eventually be renamed the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society in New York. They're under the... It's a little bit confusing. You got this organization that actually is in New York, and then you've got the official corporation, which is the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Pennsylvania. It was incorporated in Pennsylvania, but their headquarters are in New York. And so you've got the New York branch reporting to the main corporate headquarters there in New York. And then Second Adventist is just another name for Adventist. These are names you'll hear associated over history with JW's. Now, to us today, the only thing we really hear about, think about, is JW's. And they're the predominant group. And we generally refer to them as Jehovah's Witnesses, I guess, when they come forward. Early on, they were independent structures. The congregations, that would change as time went on. Okay, we're going to talk about structure here for a second. Remember what Covington said as he tried to describe what the organization was. And then think about that in view of what we actually see the organization is. And obviously think of it in terms of what the Bible has said. You might want to pick out of your book back there, and you may not, this little chart, Appendix 4. Just kind of have it in front of you to go through this. I don't know what page it is. It's a fairly straightforward organization chart for a major corporation, which it is. So let's talk a little bit about it, and you can kind of follow along. And a lot of these you've heard, a lot of these terms you've heard, some of them will be new to you in this class. As I mentioned before, pre-71, the seven governing body members and the seven board of directors were all the same seven men. Two hats they wore, but same seven men. 71, they changed that. And we ended up adding some people, as I mentioned a while ago. The board of directors was, at one time, seven members, supposed to be seven members on the board of directors. And they have their office, they hold their office for 2 to 3 years. They appoint their president out of that membership. They each have to be voted back in, basically, reinstated to keep it after the 2 to 3 years. So it's not too unlike a corporation board. And that's not unlike the way they operate in any particular business. And they're responsible for appointing the president for the society. As I mentioned earlier, the directors must, by charter, be of the elect class. That's 144,000. So put yourself in the skin of somebody that wants to be on the board of directors. How do you know you're on the board? How do you know you're one of the class? Where's the objective evidence that I'm one of the 144,000, therefore you can put me on the board?
Within your own heart.
That's it. It's the way I feel. That's the only way you can do it. Interestingly, the fellow Covington I mentioned earlier, who was on the board, actually resigned because he decided he felt like he wasn't really one of the elected class. So he stepped in. And he's probably rare that happened. And since that time, he actually, after he did that, he actually eventually parted ways with the organization. Their whole business has been to frame policy and make sure things head in the right direction. Then you have a class called Publishers and Pioneers. I'll split those out when we talk about membership in a minute. But this is a class, this is a group, and has certain criteria that put you into these positions. And you have congregations, and congregations have appointed members that are called overseers or elders at each given, and each is given a specific role within the congregation. And we'll speak about that in a minute. There is a presiding overseer that leads the elder meetings, and then there are some others that we'll talk about in a minute. Circuits are about groups of about 20 congregations served by circuit overseer. And the circuit overseer periodically goes out to each congregation, goes about twice a year, and has a 1 week period he spends there, and he'll have a couple day convention while he's there. The districts, by the way, you know, let me clarify one thing. I would be obvious to you on the organization chart. The first two, governing board of director, those are the top. Actually, number 8 is the next one down. And then number 7 and number 6. So I got this organized upside down for you. Districts are made up of circuits. You've got 22 districts in the U.S. and other places would be different. And there are district conventions once a year. And then a number of districts are formed into a branch, a number of branches into a zone. So if you look at your chart, you start off the top with the corporation, and it's got its board of directors, governing body in that corporation, Tract Society of Pennsylvania. They will have various branches reporting to them. I mentioned the New York corporation being a branch, which it is. And then there will be a district underneath that. And by the way, they're in the U.S., like I said, there are 22 districts. So you can just, I didn't try to fill this kind of thing out with all the numbers. Just to give you a sense, like district is the very last box is districts 3 through 22, and they all look the same. Then you've got a circuit. So you got circuit 1, circuit 2, and there's 26 circuits, for example. And they're reporting to the circuit reports to the district reports to the branch. Branch, I don't show zone. There are zones, but I'm not sure where they are applied. Not everywhere. Where needed is where they have the zone. And then you have congregations. You'll have 20, about, you know, it'll vary, but about 20 congregations can be under a circuit. And then the people are going to be in the congregation, the various people. else? Al Clarity?
I noticed while I was in Atlanta that they were having the convention there for the JWs.
Oh, were they?
Yes.
They have a lot of conventions. When you think about all these groups, and they have a variety of conventions.
Well, imagine it's not cheap to rent a place in a big city. No.
Okay, let's talk about the membership. This is an exclusive group. Oh, by the way, this is the organization. Covington said, then, of course, is Death Apostles Convention inside Jerusalem, and they were considered the governing body of the church. The Church of Jerusalem, the only apostles there in Jerusalem, were considered to be the governing body of the church. I believe they had about 70 in number, and that's kind of where it stops. Does this sound anything like that? I guess you could use the word governing body. That's about the only thing you use. And elders. They got elders. To my knowledge, they don't claim apostles. You know, like the Mormons
did. It's nowhere near what the early church looked like.
Well, obviously.
but that was the quote. It's exactly.
Yes, precisely.
Precisely.
Yeah. And you wonder what's out of the world some people get up on. Okay. So, members. Now, this is in order of organization, top to bottom. Okay. For the branch, they have some, and I'm not talking about the board and the governing body that's talking about that. The branch has something called branch servant. And generally, it's over a nation or over an area. And I believe an area in a group of nations depends on where he is, where the branch is. And he's the direct representative of society in that area. And he controls all the affairs of the society in that area. And obviously he's appointed by the corporation. And any of these branch little headquarters I mentioned are called Bethel. To give you a sense, when I got the data together a number of years ago, and I'm sure it's a little different now, the New York Bethel office then had about 800 people. I suspect it's grown substantially since then. They were being paid, that their pay, and this counts president on down, I mean, they don't distinguish, they don't differentiate. They were got room and board, clothing allowance, and now, way back when, it's getting about $14, that was a long time ago, $14 a day, a month. Now it's up to about $200 a month of spending money. And they have, their food, large dining room, food there, they can stay there, just basically self-contained if they choose to do that. If you've got to travel to society, you do get your expenses paid, your traveling expenses paid. No pension, supposedly no material benefits, other material benefits for the workers. I don't know what they do, if they get vacation or any of that. Really not important. The point is, we've got a lot of labor in an organization, and they are cheap. Cheap, cheap. And so it's cheap labor to do what they do. Below the branch, and of course, the district, you've got a district servant, again, appointed by the organization. He reports to the branch servant. 26 circuits will be his responsibility. And his big duty, apart from being an administrator, is to send reports in about what's going on. And actually, his reports end up being part of their annual yearbook of the society. And if I recall right, you can go on their website if you're so inclined, and you can find the yearbook of the society on that website. Below that is the circuit. Therefore, has a circuit servant. And we'll pick up at 3. We will get nothing happened. Nothing dramatic happens. We should get through this without Yeah, we should get through this. When we get to the table, read the table. I mean, some of this stuff is just, some of it is fascinating, some of it makes you sick. And we'll try to get that. I don't know, we may get into some of the prophetic speculation business. Won't be very far, but hopefully we'll get into some of that. Any comments, questions before we break up?